no fair. You change the outcome by measuring it.
Catapult of propaganda.
The truth is out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody, and welcome to our bunker. It's, it's Thursday, May the 25th.
That's
what
right.
About that date rings in my head?
All supposed to be dead! Sorry, didn't mean to startle anyone. But
you know, I had something happen today that would have been, it would have been terrible, prediction or not.
Yes, that's true.
But funny thing about that prediction, the sight is gone.
Yes. We are talking, of course, about Eric Julien, who was the French gentleman, the former air traffic controller, who predicted that a trailing piece of comet Strassmann-Vachmann, 73P, yes, was supposed to impact the Atlantic Ocean today, which was going to cause, death and destruction and tidal waves, not just tidal waves, but tsunamis that were going to destroy life as we know it around the Atlantic. And in fact, there were people in the African nation of Morocco who basically evacuated the coastline and headed for higher ground.
Well, I suppose I can understand that. But, you know, this guy, he works ostensibly for the Science Institute of the Science of Aliens is what he's. No, that's his book. Sorry, I'm looking at the article right now. There is an article, of course, on WatcherMagazine.com about it. I really don't know what happened to him. This afternoon when I posted this story, his website was still there.
Yeah.
Some of the links were broken. As of now, the site's gone.
That's right. By 7:30 Central Time, which is it's about 1:30 Greenwich Mean Time, the website now says service not available when you try to get to it. His website was SaveLivesInMay.com, SaveLivesInMay.com. It'll be interesting to see if anything goes back up, but his prediction was that the last remaining fragment of Comet 73P was going to cause massive destruction on the Earth today, and at least as of 7:30 Central Time here in the United States, that has not come to pass.
That's right. I'm looking at the USGS site right now, and there's nothing on there that is out of the ordinary.
Right. Now we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, mentioned it one time and just kind of let it go, although we did pay attention to Comet 73P because it was coming fairly close as near-Earth objects go, and there was that one piece that 3BD or whatever it was that NASA kind of lost track of and said, well, it could be anywhere from 35 times the distance from here to the moon to 0.04 times the distance from here to the moon. Obviously, that missed us also. And we're thankful that it did. We take note of the near-Earth objects only because it's prophesied in the Bible that someday we will see rocks falling from the skies.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like fallen angels hurling stuff at us.
Right. So, you know, it is something that we pay attention to. And there are a lot of people who aren't prophetically aware, who have no interest in end times prophecy, who just, you know, look around at the scars from past impacts and say, you know, we really ought to pay attention to these things.
So if we do, this is what they usually say.
Right. So we did note it. But Mr. Julien, or Monsieur Julien, received his communique that this was going to hit by telepathic communication from the visitors who were going to throw it at us to in response, I guess, to an American invasion of Iran. So I don't know. Maybe
we
a new
don't
page
know what his story
and,
is. Perhaps, you know, if he's a legit guy, and by that I mean if this was not a money making scam, then he may resurface.
Yeah, we'll see. These prophets, like these sorts of false prophets, have a tendency of reinventing themselves and somehow, you know, attracting more attention.
You know, speaking of false prophets, whatever happened to the prophet Yahweh?
He's been pretty quiet lately, hasn't he?
He was going to call down all these UFOs.
Yeah, yeah. And that never really seemed to materialize. We'll have to do some digging into that.
Hmm.
Well, the guys who were doing the talking and, you know, laying it out the way it is tonight were the Prime Minister of the UK, Tony Blair, and American President George W. Bush had a press conference tonight to talk about the situation in Iraq and congratulate the new constitutionally elected government in Baghdad.
For the life of me, I can't figure out what that whole thing was about. Ordinarily, Washington does not have press conferences. This was a press conference, mm-hmm. not a speech. It was a press conference, and they ordinarily hold these in the morning or the early afternoon. This one was held during prime time.
Mm-hmm.
It was held right after Blair got off the plane.
Mm-hmm.
He barely had any time to sit and, you know, just look around. I haven't been here for a while. I just want to look around.
Sure.
No, get in here. We're going to. And afterward, of course, he was asked out to dinner by Bush. So, you know.
They've got dinner and a
movie.
They've
got plans.
Yeah. So that should be a fun night for them. And I presume Sherry and Laura will go along and chaperone. So that should be a fun night for the Bushes and the Blairs. I can only guess that this was a rah-rah session.
Photo op.
It was a photo op and a rah-rah session. And
but they could have done that this afternoon.
They could have done it this afternoon. I can only guess that it was done at this time to allow for the time difference between here and the UK. I mean, they're 5 hours ahead of the East Coast of the U.S. So to do it early afternoon would have been like doing it 8 o'clock in the morning for Tony.
Okay.
For Prime Minister Blair.
To do it 6:30 in the evening is doing it 11:30 in the evening there.
No, okay, you're right. I'm reversing the time. You're right. It was actually rather. It would have been rather.
Wouldn't it have been better to have it this morning? Now, granted, he didn't get here until this evening.
You're right. It would have been better to do it in the afternoon for Prime Minister Blair. Yeah, he was probably a little jet lagged, and to be honest, I've seen him sharper. So, he gave his usual appearance. I mean, he gave his usual fine accounting of himself. They both spoke pretty well.
He did, and let's just remind everybody: Blair's on the hot seat over in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
He is tenuously holding on to number 10.
Right.
Tenuously on the 10.
That's right. Gordon Brown's made it very clear that he wants the job.
Yeah.
And it looks like he's going to get it. The question I have, though, was which Iraq was George Bush talking about during the press conference? He talked about a land in which the people of Iraq are enjoying their freedom. They've got a new democratically elected representative government in Baghdad that will guarantee that the freedoms and rights of all Iraqis are protected and preserved. And as soon as they're ready to stand on their feet, we're just going to disappear and, you know, ride off into the sunset. Is this the same Iraq that enshrined Sharia law into its new constitution? Which basically means that if you're a Hindu or a Jew or a Christian or an atheist, your life is basically
toast.
Toast.
The same
Iraq that sent a representative to the Arab League boycott office in Damascus to participate in the official boycott of the State of Israel. Is that the same Iraq that the president is speaking of?
Well, you know, he chooses to see with rose-colored glasses from his rose garden.
Mm-hmm. I assume so. The same government that if the people there had its way, seeing as how the majority are of the same sect of Islam as their next-door neighbor Iran, would become Iran's new best friend? Well, yeah, democratically elected government, but only as long as they do what we want them to do.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, let's leave those two alone.
Right.
They're busy. We'll find out tomorrow what they did and what movie they went to see. In Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
The volcano is a-blowing, and you know what? I don't know if it's Mount Merapi or Merapi. I've heard both.
Mm-hmm.
But this volcano is erupting, and apparently there are about 20,000 people who live on the slopes of this volcano who will not go because they believe that a spirit lives up there, and the king of this spirit world has to give them a sign before they are free to leave.
You know what? If it were me, the sign of red hot lava flowing down the side of the mountain would be my sign. That would be the sign. The picture's right there.
I know.
It looks like the mountain is splitting in half. It looks like Mount Doom.
It does. That, it does.
I don't live there.
And
I'm not an expert.
I also know that they just sent a shaman up there to do some kind of ceremony. This is really a big deal to these people. It's paganism. It is wrong. It is worshiping demons. But these people somehow believe that this is going to work.
Well, I...
And if they leave, it's just going to make you mad.
Oh, boy. Well, I just pray for those folks because, again, it's we may laugh, but, I mean, the tragedy of this is that many of these 20,000 people that live on the slopes of the mountain may end up dead.
And many of these are kids, and they have no choice as to whether they go or not. They have to go where their parents go. And we all remember the story of the old hermit who lived on the side of Mount St. Helens and just refused to go. And he did die when that mountain blew. And Mount St. Helens wasn't looking like this. This looks pretty nasty.
It does. Go to watchermagazine.com if you've not seen a picture of this volcano erupting already. The picture makes it pretty clear that it's not safe to stay.
No.
It's not safe to stay. And you're right. Many of these people who are staying behind are children. And that's really a tragedy.
Well, yeah, speaking of volcanoes, there's something going on in Washington. We've seen some smoke.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little lava.
Mm-hmm.
But I think something's about to blow there.
It's a good segue.
Thank you very much. It has to do with this Representative Jefferson story. The story now coming out from ABC News about Hastert.
Mm-hmm.
A Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert. There is something there, and I'm not really sure what it is yet, but I suspect, well, I'll get to this in a minute. My brain wanted to go elsewhere really quickly, but before I say that, let me just set it up a little better. If you've not read the stories, Representative Jefferson from Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
yeah?
Yeah, he represents New Orleans.
Exactly. Is in big trouble because he was videotaped ostensibly, allegedly, what are the other legal ifs I can put in there, that he was supposed to have been accepting a bribe. Well, he says mm-hmm. that, first of all, one story says he pled guilty. He told his constituents, no, I'm innocent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's somewhere in there. And he supposedly was supposed to be taking the money over to Africa.
Yeah, Nigeria, to basically grease the skids for some sort of a business deal there. And, of course, we know Nigeria, like many parts of Africa, has a lot of oil.
Exactly. Well, the FBI decided to descend upon his office. Was the FBI? Yeah, the FBI. They seized his computer, seized the hard drive, and two boxes of papers. This is from his office inside Congress,
right.
Inside the Capitol building.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis Hastert, Speaker of the House,
a Republican,
was really, really angry. He felt that it was a breach of the wall that is supposed to exist between executive and legislative.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went steaming about this. Mount Hastert blew. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, within a day, we had a story come out that came out yesterday from ABC News. Hastert is in the mix. That's a quote, in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow he's involved in some scandal in Washington. It was almost like they were saying, ABC, assuming that their story is true, someone was leaking it to ABC to get a message to Hastert,
mm-hmm.
stand down, sir.
Right.
He now says, he being Dennis Hastert, that the Chicago FBI leaked the story to intimidate him.
Mm-hmm. And that was our first response when we heard that the information, when we heard the information about Hastert.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to stand up and say, or did stand up and say, this is unconstitutional.
Oh, he was really steamy.
You cannot go into a congressman's office inside the Capitol building and just and toss it, which is what the FBI apparently did.
They apparently did.
So next thing you know, ABC's reporting that Hastert is himself being investigated.
And now today we hear from President Bush, who is weighing in and ordering that all the records that were seized have to be sealed for 45 days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may simply be a courtesy to the Jefferson lawyers who have to go through the material and figure out what it is their defense is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be something a little more sinister. Let me just take you visually in your memories to a movie called The Godfather. Well, if I could just cue the music.
I can in the mix later. Yeah,
it's good music. Toward the end, we see Michael Corleone standing as the godfather to his nephew.
Mm-hmm.
And while he's saying these vows to God, he's having all of his enemies rubbed out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm starting to feel like the music's starting up in Washington.
You know, that's an interesting analogy. It seems that anybody who stands up against this administration winds up... And it's not just this administration. I mean, Nixon had his list of enemies.
Mm-hmm.
The Clintons had FBI files on everybody. And now you've got apparently a power struggle going on inside the Beltway mm-hmm. between the executive branch and everybody else is yeah. almost the way it looks. The intelligence community's been fighting back and forth, and we'll talk about that a little more in just a minute. We're trying to figure out how these pieces fit together, and looking in from the Midwest out here in Red State America, we're not quite seeing how it all fits just yet.
No, but you're right. It sure doesn't feel right.
Yeah, and it's really a bit surprising that Hastert, who is, you know, like everybody else in Washington, probably has his fingers in a couple of pies he shouldn't, but ostensibly, you would think, an ally of the president, you know, he's the number one Republican in the House of Representatives. That is a powerful position. Mm-hmm. This is the heir to Newt Gingrich.
Right.
Hastert is more low-key, which is probably why mm-hmm. he's more effective, I would guess.
Former football coach?
He's a former football coach from West Central Illinois. And suddenly, word leaks out that he's being investigated?
Mm-hmm. And ABC is standing by the story. Yeah. They're not backing down on this.
No. Now whether ABC's source is accurate remains to be seen.
That's a good point. But add to the story something you told me at lunchtime today. You want to tell them about it was a story actually that you didn't tell me at lunch, sorry, you posted it this morning to Watcher Magazine. It was your story about how President Bush has given extra powers,
superpowers.
To John Negroponte.
Yeah, this is kind of an odd little story that was reported by Business Week a couple days ago and is just now sort of filtering through the internet. It's not been picked up by the mainstream news. And it's actually a few weeks late in coming because it was kind of snuck into the Federal Register by a memo issued by the president. And what he's done is delegated the responsibility and authority to the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, to excuse publicly traded companies from their usual accounting and securities disclosure obligations. In other words, DNI Negroponte can authorize certain companies to just waive SEC rules for these companies.
Now, if you're thinking, yawn, so what? Yeah. I think most people would, frankly, seeing the story. It just doesn't sit right with us. And so Derek and I were talking about this at lunchtime.
Yeah. Now, what purpose could be served by waiving the SEC regulations for certain companies? Now, bear in mind, most of the big defense contractors in the United States are publicly traded companies. What do they report to the Securities and Exchange Commission that could potentially threaten national security, which is, I would assume, why he would delegate this responsibility to the Director of National Intelligence, the guy who's in charge of the CIA and the NSA. The thing that really troubles me is that the guys who are specialists in securities law don't really understand what this means yet.
Mm-hmm.
This memo was issued on May the 5th, and it was so blandly titled that it really snuck past most people until somebody read it and said, hey, wait a minute. According to one securities law expert, what this might hide are investments. You've spent unseen millions of dollars on some new technology that might be used by the United States Department of Defense,
mm-hmm.
and you don't want that getting out. Well, I can understand that. But what we wonder is, would this possibly be used to hide something like the big inquiry for ammunition that we just sent over to Russia?
Mm-hmm.
A deal that could be worth as much as $400 million.
This really smells like an attempt to keep a paper trail from ever existing.
Right. Another legal expert who deals with securities speculated that this might also allow companies to play fast and loose with their books.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to create another Enron. Exactly. Create another Enron for somebody who's buddy-buddy with the government. And all you need to do in order to justify it is say, well, this is national security implications.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can start shuffling their books around however they want because they don't have to report anything to the SEC. Now, what's not well known is that this is a power that the United States presidency has had since the Carter administration. This isn't a new power just invented by the Bush administration. Bush is just the first one to delegate this responsibility and authority to someone outside the Oval Office. So Negroponte now has the power to just wave his magic wand, his magic national security wand, tap certain corporations on the head. Boing! Bing!
He's super DNI!
That's right. You no longer have to report what you do to the SEC. Lockheed Martin, bing, you no longer have to report to the SEC. And
you don't get sound effects like this on Just Ever.
That's
show,
right. Yeah, Alex Jones doesn't do stuff like this. Let me tell you that.
No.
Now, we don't imitate mad spider-like creatures, but
we could, you
know, if that's something you want to hear.
Exactly.
So anyway, but here's the thing that Sharon speculated, which I think is very interesting to consider. Could this particular power be used to cover the sudden and unexpected transfer of large sums of money out of a particular sector, not just one company, but out of a particular sector,
like
of the
out of
economy,
the airline sector.
Yes, a sector that could be particularly vulnerable to the next big terrorist attack. Not just airlines, but think insurance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was an example, but you're right.
Shipping.
There are so many sectors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, frankly, if you get into the into corn and any of the markets,
right?
Mm-hmm. They could be, depending on what happens. Take out the Midwest, suddenly your soybeans are gone.
Mm-hmm. So it is a very interesting story, and you'll find it at Watcher Magazine. And again, we credit Business Week for picking up on this and posting it. It's a story we'd like to see more of the mainstream news sources paying a little attention to, just like we'd like to see somebody inside the United States pay attention to this story about this $400 million arms deal with Russia for Afghanistan. The only places we've seen it, The Telegraph in the UK, which broke the story, and then today I saw it in The Standard, which is a Hong Kong business journal. If you do a search, you'll find it very difficult to locate the story anywhere but those two sources.
You know, it's. I think what we're finding out is that these stories, again, the rule is you have to tell them. You mm-hmm. have to be upfront because you have to tell them. But you don't have to just tell them, you know, through ways that they'll find out. You can, you know, put it in the Hong Kong paper, or you could put it in the Australian paper, or mm-hmm. someplace else that they may not read. There's one more story I want to get to before we get to the next interview, and that is, who's the interview today?
David Flynn.
David Flynn again. Yeah, it's continuing with David Week. Sorry, I should have looked up at the board. My brain was on this story because this story is another one that is just so deplorable. It's the story about the veterans' data that was
mm-hmm.
stolen.
Right.
Well, apparently, it happened on May 3rd.
Interesting. And it's just now coming into the news?
Just now coming into the news. The only reason that anybody at the VA found out about it is because it was revealed at a routine meeting on May 10th.
And
a week went by.
Mm-hmm.
This was not reported.
Yeah, and the 10th was 2 weeks ago. So now we're just hearing about it in the
mainstream press. 3 weeks
later. Yeah. And the fact is that this data analyst who lost this data has admitted at that meeting that he'd been taking this information home with him for 3 years.
For 3 years? Why on earth would he have to do that? Look, if you can't do your job at work, the only reason you take data like that, I mean, let me just say this. Most people who work for the state or for the federal government are not inclined to be the kind of go-getter that wants to take work home and work at it in the evening,
mm-hmm.
on his or her own time.
Right.
Most of these people don't get paid very well. Why on earth should this person want to take his work home for 3 years? In other words, couldn't he get it done at work? Now, my thinking is either he was an extremely unusual man,
mm-hmm.
and therefore so conscientious that for 3 years, anything he didn't get done during the day, he took home with him diligently every night, even though it broke the rules to take it home.
Mm-hmm.
Or he was doing something with that data at home at night that had nothing to do with his job.
Yep.
And this is the third one, he's lying. He has not been taking it home for 3 years.
Hmm.
He took it home specifically so it could be stolen.
Yep. How valuable would this information be to someone? I don't know what you could do this with this information. I suspect you could use it for all kinds of malfeasance.
Suddenly you have a whole lot of illegal aliens that have legitimate Social Security numbers.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps are able to collect benefits.
Yes. or you have people who are trying to get into the country to do us harm that suddenly have legitimate IDs.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And as we've speculated before, really getting into tinfoil hat territory, once again, perhaps this is simply to help convince the American public that we all need to have little radio transmitters injected under our skin.
Mm-hmm.
Possible.
Well, that's true. Well, you know what? Speaking of radio transmitters and tinfoil hats, David Flynn probably has the coolest tinfoil hat of all. Because he is so good with numbers and angles and things. I'm betting if he sat down to make a tinfoil hat, his could be the coolest.
We should have
a tinfoil hat contest.
Ooh, brilliant. We'll talk about that.
More after
this. But I'll bet his would look really neat in very precise geometric lines and angles.
I know.
David Flynn has done some amazing work, not just with End Times Prophecy, but his book, Cydonia, The Hidden Chronicles of Mars, Secret Chronicles of Mars, excuse me, is an amazing look at the geometric relationships between locations on Mars and areas on Earth and how they fit together and tie together. You might dismiss it as wild speculation, but you have to admit that the probability of these things being random chance is very low. So do check that out and pay close attention and take notes.
Well, you're going to need the notes
over the next 2 nights.
You guys need a really big whiteboard like our, you know, Board of Paranoia, because it's great for standing there and just writing things down.
Yes, and we go now to our part one of our interview with David Flynn.
David Flynn is the editor and publisher of the Watcher website, watcherwebsite.com, and also the author of just an excellent and really provocative book, Cydonia, The Secret Chronicles of Mars. David Flynn, welcome back to PID Radio.
Thanks, Derek. I'm really glad to be back.
You know what, David? We have missed you, and we've gotten so many emails from people. When's Dave Flynn coming back on? Well, we know you're busy.
Yeah, too busy, but not too busy to talk to you guys.
Thanks so much.
We appreciate that. And the first interview that we did, and if you at home listening have not listened to the interview that we did with Dave last year, go back and find it in the archives. And if you have iTunes on your computer, whether you've got a Windows machine or a Mac, download the enhanced version of the podcast with the graphics in there so you'll get an understanding.
Yeah, we no longer do the enhanced version because it just makes for too big a file.
But, right.
If you have a whiteboard or lots of pieces of paper, take notes and draw diagrams.
Yes, and you too can have your own wall of paranoia, just like we in the bunker.
That's right.
Well, Dave,
and buy his book because that does help a lot.
Yes.
Good companion piece for the interviews.
So, in fact, I was even toying with the idea based on, you know, what we're going to dive into here, doing a special, maybe another one-time-only enhanced podcast with the graphics, depending on how important they will be to understanding what we're going to talk about. But we're in the middle of a series on prophecy and wanted to dig into your area of expertise and some of the connections you've made, Dave, on the connections that you find numerically, symbolically, geographically, that place the United States into an end times context.
Well, it is pretty amazing, and the way I actually kind of stumbled into it, it's a progression of over a couple of years of having a question and looking into it and setting the information aside, and then having inspiration and coming back and seeing something that I hadn't seen before. And a couple of days ago, I was toying around with my Bible code software. It's a real archaic version of it. It's called Torah for You. And it comes out of Israel. So I guess, you know, it's just some Hebrew speakers play on English words or something.
Uh-huh. Kip, kip, Torah.
Anyway, I put America into the program. And you know, you can set up how many spaces you want this equal distant letter sequence to appear in. And that's how the code works. You know, it searches for whatever word you put into the string of text, and then it just finds how far away, you know, the actual spaces of the letters are. And I could find America over and over and over again in hundreds of places. But the place that it shows up at the least amount of skips is -17. And I thought, well, it seems like the most significant Bible codes are the ones that you have these words placed in the closest ELS, I guess. That's a short for the equal letter sequence, and it appears in Daniel 3:3. And so I read this text, Daniel 3:3, where the skips is happening 17 letters apart. And it turns out that it's a part of a, it's a story of during the Babylonian exile for the Jews, Nebuchadnezzar had set up an obelisk. And it was gold, and he set it up in Babylon. And he has a herald say, now when you hear all this music play, the psaltery, the sackbut, the harp, the drums, everything you can think of, then everybody, all the nations and peoples and tongues, need to bow down and worship this thing. And if they don't do this, then in the same hour, they're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace. And this is where this ELS of America shows up, 17 spaces. So I've always seen these things with numerical significance. And there's some opponents of the Bible code who say, well, you know, that there's so many variances on the text and, you know, just changing one letter just distorts all, you know, all these sequences, and you're really not going to be able to pay that much attention to it. But the more I've been looking at numbers themselves and the way we actually measure things in time and space, mathematics in general, have been laid out very early in history, prehistory, actually. And these things have been held sacred to especially the fraternal organizations, the fraternal sorts of occult mystery school organizations, namely the Freemasons, who had a huge influence in putting the architecture in Washington, D.C., and setting up dates and times for our country to be built around. 1776 is a really good example.
Mm-hmm.
That has huge occult significance. And I'll get back to that. But,
good, because I know we'll get email if you don't.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, wow, you know, here's Nebuchadnezzar having all these nations and peoples and tongues fall down to their MTV. And then you look at America, and the biggest obelisk in the world today is in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Washington Monument. And the Washington Monument was conceived something like 7 years after 1776. So that number 7 shows up again. Washington, D.C. itself is at 77 degrees longitude. Just exactly. It's perfectly on there. In fact, if you go to the Google Earth program, I don't know if you played with that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we love it.
Astounding thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually get a little cursor, and you can put it on the Capitol, the Washington Capitol building, and you can get 77 degrees, 00 minutes, 33 seconds.
Oh, my goodness.
The numbers are completely, you know.
Wow.
Amazing. What's more amazing is that was actually set up at 77 degrees before the meridian that we know of right now that's in Greenwich was actually established, which adds to the mystery even further, because if Washington was, D.C. was set up the way it is, it's exacting when it comes to being aligned on the 77th meridian. The latitude of Washington is at 35 or 38.5, which is half 77. So the whole complex is a play on this location that, you know, 77 is twice its latitude.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, you end up with this sort of mathematical signature of where the place is. So getting back into the actual story of Nebuchadnezzar having people bow down to these to this obelisk. In the story, of course, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these were Jewish guys who had ended up being exiled to Babylon. And the Babylonians had destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in 586 B.C. And then in 538 B.C., the Persians took over Babylon, and Cyrus the Great was ruling. He was from Persia, the Medes and the Persians. I guess Darius the Mede was the guy that went and actually took Jerusalem over, but Cyrus the Great was ruling as a Persian, and Darius was the Medes. So it was kind of a group of these ancient peoples. And Cyrus actually let the Jews go back to Jerusalem and build their temple again. So you have this parentheses from 586 to 538 when the Jews are in exile. And that's the time of this actual story that you find in Daniel 3:3. Amazingly, then, if you take the actual numbers of this code where you find America in this place in Daniel 3:3, and you actually look at the number that's spacing the letters apart, 17, and then you count the actual words that have these letters that are spaced 17 letters apart, you'll find 33 Hebrew words together. Hmm. And 33 times 17 gives you 561. And if you're looking at the exile of the Jews in Babylon, that puts you right in the center. It's perfectly in the center of 586 and 538 BC, mm-hmm. which to me is saying, you know, basically you're looking at the time here. You're looking at about a 24-year period from after the exile mm-hmm. when Nebuchadnezzar decides to do this thing. And that's actually encoded in the code. And then you look back at America, and you look at this date that's been is so patriotic, 1776. You know,
I thought they were there for longer than 48 years, though.
They were there for 70 years. Israel had been taken out first, and then Judah later.
Mm-hmm.
And so Judah was the last one to go. And when Judah was taken out, that was in 586, and the
right.
temple was destroyed.
Right, and that was Daniel's prayer, of course. He thought the 70 years that God had said.
Yeah. So, and Israel and Judah were, you know, they're two different sections. They were separated in Israel at the time. And so the whole exile lasted for 70 years, but interestingly, Judah's exile lasted for 49, which is 7 times 7, and you're talking 306 biblical years.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up, you know, you're using biblical day years to measure these things out. But there's this interplay between regular Gregorian calendar years or solar years and biblical years, and it kind of gets a little bit dicey when you're having to work on a calculator to figure out if there's any meaning here. But 49 is just 7 times 7
mm-hmm.
again. So that number is repeated again in the actual destruction of the temples and then finally the release of the Jews from Babylon captivity to build the temple again. So the number is repeated again. So I took 1776 and I divided it by 3.3, which was kind of suggested in that place where the code shows up for America at Daniel 3, verse 3. That's where it starts.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, you come up with an actual date, 538. 1776 divided by 3.3 is 538, which is exactly the year that Babylon fell to the Medes and the Persians, and Cyrus the Great let the Jews go. There's more, though. If you take 1776 and you put the decimal point between 17 and 76, and you multiply that times 33, you get 586, which was the year the temple was destroyed and the Jews went into exile in Babylon.
Oh my goodness.
So it actually marks exactly when the exile began for Judah and ended. And so you're placed right in the center of that situation, and you're actually looking at the code pointing out the date and the time and the whole event that you're reading in the forward narrative of the Daniel 3:3. That really piqued my interest because that's, you know, there has to be more to it, and there is.
So, we suspected as much.
Yeah, you have a. If you look at, you know, go to some of these federal sites on the web, and you look up at the Washington Monument, you find some really intriguing things, and they fit right into Daniel 3:3. It says that there, the base of the Washington Monument, there's plaques. There's 188 plaques from all nations and peoples and tongues. That's the actual word that I found used.
Mm.
And the actual building of this thing was in, I guess they built it until it was, I think it was 1884, where they had some problems finishing it, and it was only about 150 feet high, which is about a third of its total height, which they finished when the thing was completed in 1888. And this number 1888 is pretty interesting because three eights together, 888, is half 1776.
Hmm.
888 is the Greek gematria number for the name Jesus.
Right.
And we know that Jesus has two advents. He came the first time, and he's going to come the second time.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what 1776 is actually symbolizing mathematically is the second advent of the Messiah. Only if you're looking at it from a Gnostic, mm-hmm. Sort of paternal, mystical version of Jesus, you're looking at the manifestation, at least from their version, of the bringer of light.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And Jesus to them isn't the son of Yahweh. He's the son of Lucifer, or he's Lucifer incarnate. And that's a heavy thing to say, but if you read Pike's Morals and Dogma, he just gets down and says, well, you know, Lucifer is God.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's pretty clear on that. And
well, and there's a popular belief that that's taking off now, that Jesus was trained in the Gnostic sects over in Egypt, and that he was proclaimed to be the son of the Lightbringer.
Yeah, during the missing years.
Yeah, during the missing years.
Yeah.
And you can say almost anything you want.
Yeah. Well, he visited India and Britain and everywhere else in between.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing. If you've looked at the beginnings of America, you find out that there's so much Freemason influence in the symbology that was put together, the dates that were set up for starting this country. They're taken for granted because they're all parts of a conspiracy theory, which is starting to fall in disfavor in the modern secular sorts of views. There's a big reason for that, too. It's to keep the information away.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a spiritual battle going on, too, that keeps people from looking at things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Except, if, of course, they have the spirit of all truth, which we have, and you can see through it. These numbers continued, and I don't think I'll tell you too much more because you can go to my forum and you can actually look at this write-up that I did on it.
Oh, okay. And it's at watchyourwebsite.com?
Yeah, and there's a link to the forum, and you just go there, and it's under serious warning, which my brother said you should have spelled it.
S-I-R-I-U-S?
Yeah. Well, that kind of fits.
But now, where is the link for Serious Warning? I'm looking at your main page right now.
Yeah. It's under Watcher Forum.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And you'll end up seeing all the equations and math, and you can pull out your calculator and follow along and see if it makes any sense.
Play along at home.
Yeah. Well, the most amazing thing is, here you have this prophecy showing up at a certain time in history when the Jews were in exile in Babylon. And it actually is mathematically encoded in the Bible code in Daniel 3:3. But then in text, there's also some interesting things, too, that I don't think people have realized. The actual penalty for not falling down and worshiping Nebuchadnezzar's obelisk was to be thrown in the fiery furnace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that Cyrus the Great, who conquered Babylon in one night, his name, Cyrus, means possessor of the furnace. So you end up with this kind of irony of God saying, the Babylonians aren't going to destroy you through fire and, judgment in this way. And then a man whose name is, one who possesses the furnace comes and actually liberates the Jews.
Hmm.
His name is pronounced, I guess, in Hebrew, Koresh, which
David Koresh.
Yeah, there's something interesting in that too.
That's
yes.
Really creepy, considering how they all died.
Yeah, in a conflagration,
yes.
A fiery furnace, which I haven't looked into. I thought about that yesterday about 4 a.m, so I haven't looked into it any much more than.
Yeah, that's a whole other trail, especially considering that Koresh was not his given name, was it?
I
don't believe that was his name. I think he had taken that name.
He took that name. He was born Vernon Wayne Howell.
Huh. Well, that That thickens the plot.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Make note. Go back to that later.
Well, you know, we're taught in Scripture that names have, they're important. In fact, when believers go to be with Christ in heaven or where, whatever you want to call it, when we go to our eternal life, that we are given a new name.
Well, I think that would be pretty cool. You know, I have a name right now that I think is great. I'm not sure my parents were Catholics, but they named me with some inspiration, I think, that was a little bit beyond their wisdom. And, you know, because David is a great Hebrew name.
Mm-hmm.
And although I'm not Hebrew or anything, I've looked back into my genealogy and the name Flynn. It turns out that Flynn is a strange Gaelic form of the word phoenix. And phoenix, of course, is like this mystical bird that dies in the flames of its own kind of creation and is reborn again. But that comes out of this Phoenicia, the whole place where all this knowledge comes from to begin with,
mm-hmm.
Because Phoenicia, where Lebanon is now,
mm-hmm.
It was also called Canaan, and its boundaries extended, you know, all the way into Israel and up all the way north, and into Syria and all the way up to where Turkey is, and it's from there that the Genesis 6 scenario began. Especially if you look at, you know, the Book of Enoch and some extra biblical texts, it talks about the mountain that the watchers descended on, and that's Mount Hermon, which mm-hmm. is right up against Phoenicia. And that's another thing too I find really strange, because if you look at the ancient text, hands down, you'll find that they looked at ancient Phoenicia as the origin for knowledge itself and all the systems of knowledge. People talk about Sumeria and Babylon being the origins of these things. And they worshipped this mountain, too,
mm-hmm.
as being the place where knowledge came down.
Mm-hmm.
And Phoenicia or Lebanon right now is one of the least studied in archaeology and history of any country there is. And you can find places like Sidon, which is incredibly significant when it comes to Bible history, that has maybe 0.05% of the area ever excavated, and maybe only down to maybe the era of the Crusades. But underneath all this blacktop and building and all this stuff there is so much information left over from the most ancient cultures that some of the Greeks said were the progenitors of civilization. It boggles the mind how much is there and how much hasn't been uncovered. And I think part of the reason is it's part of the mystery. You're not supposed to know.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to know.
Hmm.
It's part of something that's going to come out later, I think.
You know, you mentioned Mount Hermon.
Hermon, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The verse that you used for the numbers that you were giving us earlier, Daniel 3:3.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's real. The first thing I thought of when you told me that was where you found it, was Mount Hermon, because that was where the tribe of Dan was. And Mount Hermon sits on 33 latitude.
Yes, it does. And if you're looking at the way the Templars actually measured longitude, it sits on 33 longitude.
Because they went through Paris.
Yeah, the Paris Meridian.
Hmm.
That's a strange thing, because Mount Hermon's called Mount Seir. And it's the root where you get the word Sirius. And in Egypt, the symbol for Sirius in architecture was obelisk, which is in Washington, D.C. And so the thing that you showed me about Orion being rising over Washington, D.C., and the actual
mm-hmm.
the pointer stars in the belt of Orion actually having the same angle as, I think it's Pennsylvania Boulevard.
Pennsylvania Avenue. As Sirius actually rises, and I think it's, if I remember correctly, it's on August 15th, which is the Assumption of Mary Day.
Mm-hmm. It makes a ton of sense,
mm-hmm.
because in the whole idea of what this obelisk represents and Sirius as a star being represented by this architectural point, it's actually a phallic symbol for the Egyptians.
Yeah.
It goes all the way back to the story of Osiris and Isis, and Osiris being destroyed by his evil brother Set and
mm-hmm.
cut up into pieces.
Well, Well, we're going to stop you there because when we want to get more into the whole story of Orion and Isis and the Evil Brothers set and how it relates to America being in prophecy, we're going to continue that tomorrow. You're going to have to wait another whole day, folks, on PID Radio with David Flynn.
Well, you know what? He is going to be David Flynn is going to be telling you much, much more tomorrow, so you don't want to miss part two of that interview as we lead up to Memorial Day weekend.
We've got a couple more great interviews this weekend. We're going to be talking with David Lowe, the author of Earthquake Resurrection. And
more
we'll
David?
More David. But we'll also be speaking with Captain Eric May, and we'll talk with him on Monday and Tuesday regarding the upcoming 6606.
Actually, we're talking with him on Sunday, but we'll be airing.
Playing it back
on. You'll be able to get
access. Destroyed the myth,
no,
the illusion of radio.
It's not live, is it? All right, everybody go home.
Well, they knew that this is a podcast. Of course, we're not live. So
we're
anyway,
pod people.
Yes.
Actually, we're PID people.
And you, for listening, are a PID head. So thank
you. Thanks, all you PID heads.
Oh, I've just insulted all our listeners. Well, anyway, we'll be airing that on Monday and Tuesday. And Monday especially we thought was appropriate because the name of his cyber intelligence unit, Captain May's intelligence unit, Ghost Troop, relates to an incident that took place during the Battle of Baghdad in 2003. And we'll let him explain that and why it's relevant.
Hey, by the way, I want to say a shout out to Camille in New York.
Oh, hello, Camille. Thank you for listening. And I should mention that John Wilkerson, who did the dramatic reading of Chapter 2 of my novel Iron Dragons, did a fabulous job. He chose that chapter because it gave him a chance to use some character voices, and the voice he chose for the dragon was excellent. John, brilliant. And I apologize because I gave an incorrect URL for his podcast last night. So if you wanted to check out the Jesus Geek podcast and listen to the dramatic reading of Iron Dragons, it's jesusgeek.info, jesusgeek.info.
He did a great job on that. I wish he would do more of those.
Yeah.
He could, you know, just read from all of our books.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I know it.
Well, our forum is always open for your participation. We look forward for your comments and suggestions. Other news items that escaped our attention, you can drop them there at the forum for other people to comment on at peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
And you can always send us your suggestions for guests or just comments on the guests we've had to radio@peeringintodarkness.com. And by the way, today the AOL mail went through.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. We had a listener who sent me a test email. I wrote back. It went through. At least one of the ones that I sent yesterday that I thought, well, I'll just, you know, not even send it ever again. I tried it again today. It went through. None of the Watcher News headlines bounced back. About five or six of those at least went to AOL addresses, if not more. So for some reason today, we were not banned.
Huh.
I don't know, because I will say neither you nor I had a conversation with anyone from AOL.
No, that's true. That's true. And I guess they didn't even get cheese that I posted the note to our forum that said that AOL actually stands for Ain't Online.
Because you're not, you know. It's a fake.
No, that'll get us banned for sure.
I know, but they've got a pyramid with an eye in it. What do you expect?
That's true. Well, we look forward to part two with David Flynn tomorrow night. And until then, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Have a great evening, everybody.
Gonna step up to the microphone. Say it loud.